we are in the realm of the highest experiences. These are experiences of which nothing really can be spoken, where, as he says, the mind fails, the senses founder, there is nothing to hold on to, nothing to grasp, and even the cosmic spirit fails in a luminous insufficiency. Even the spirit that upholds this universe, the cosmic consciousness, the whole universe is undone. It drops like a scaffolding. Not only the world of humans, but the world of the gods. And yet, and that is the beauty, that it is the privilege of human beings and human beings alone that we can come in contact with this transcendence. The gods cannot know this mystery. There is a beautiful line in Savitri when he is describing the worlds of the greater mind. Sri Aurobindo reveals the highest was to them unknowable. Below that, at the level of the human reason, he says, truth is not known. Why? Because only when the whole is known, that truth can be seen. One cannot know truth by the rational mind. At the intuitive mind, through the faculties of inspiration, revelation, whether we like it or not, that's the only way we can know something of truth, at least of truths. But even then, because the total vision is missing, the integral reality is missing at that level, that is also insufficient to understand or solve the riddle of this universe. We have bright hints, luminous suggestions, but not the total reality. So, Sri Aurobindo is carrying us into that. In fact, every night, for a moment, as the mother reveals to us, and Sri Aurobindo also in his letters, we touch something of this core. And it's very interesting, in our waking consciousness, we have a sense of the I. Where does this sense of I come from? How do we know? How do we call ourselves I? It's very evident we are not talking about the body, because body is changing, but we still carry the sense of I. I was, I am, I will be, different bodies. Thoughts are changing, feelings are changing. Yet we carry some sense of I. How? What is it in us that carries that sense of I? We just know by some kind of an identity. In the dream state also we carry the sense of the I. So, though we are in a different mode of consciousness, there is a different kind of experience, we go through symbol worlds, and yet we have something of the I in that. In my dream, I saw myself dead. In my dream, I saw this. And even in the dream, we are experiencing it. But going beyond, we enter into that state of deep sleep, in which the sense of I is lost. There is simply that, and we return from it saying that, oh, I was in deep sleep. It's nothing but darkness. We read that a cave of darkness guards God's light. What is that cave of darkness? It's called in the Upanishads as Susupti. We have nothing corresponding to that. Senses can register nothing in that realm. That is why even when God is right near us, nothing in us registers. We have a beautiful example of something registers at the outer level by mistake. So we have that story of Dilip Kumar Roy. He would sing, and when he sang, Krishna Prem is reported to have said that he would see Krishna right next to him, and Dilip would feel so miserable that he is not able to see him. So we don't have in our normal senses anything corresponding to that reality. It has to be developed. And even then, the highest reality, there even those senses which are subtle, through which we can converse with the gods, we can see the images of gods, we can hear their sounds. Right now we cannot hear, because gods speak in a language which we do not know. We know the joke about Amrita. Amrita was speaking to someone and someone told, we know Amrita was near Pondicherry. He was Tamil Brahmin, his mother tongue was Tamil, and someone told him, you know Amrit, God speak in Sanskrit. He said, that is half knowledge. They speak to human beings in Sanskrit, between themselves they speak in Tamil. So that was the inimitable Amrita. God speak to us. We don't hear, we don't understand. Nothing corresponds to even what they speak. Shobindo describes this experience in Chandanagar. Motilal Roy says, what is it that you are looking constantly? He says, the gods. What about gods? They come, they are writing something, they are showing me something. I am trying to understand what they are telling me. What language is that? And what? Even the gods cannot understand. We read that description. Even that collapses. They do not know. What is that consciousness? What can we speak about it? And yet we have this beauty that Sri Aurobindo brings it so close to us. Some suggestions he gives us. Hidden by its own works. It is some utter truth. It is hidden behind everything, not only the gross worlds, the subtle worlds. Impenetrable. We cannot go beyond it. It's the last mystery. It is voiceless, obscure to our senses. It is ineffable, compelling ecstasy and peace. Upanishad, Kathopanishad at one place in series of two verses describes that eternal as Sashvitim Shantirim Netaresham. Another place it describes it as Sukham, that Ananda and peace. These are two terms. How does, by what sense one feels it? We will come to that a little later. Sri Aurobindo has used the word unknowable, and he reveals to us at another place that the unknowable is because it's unknowable to the mind and the senses. If the unknowable was forever unknowable, then well, it would forever remain a mystery. That's the problem of the human mind. If he is unknowable, that means we anyways cannot know about it. It's not the agnosticism of the unknowable. It's not the agnosticism of the mind. One can know it, but not through the mind and not through the senses. That's the whole sense in it. There are other faculties through which one can know, and that's what Sri Aurobindo used the word, the supramental faculties. How does the divine know himself? By his own termless self. Divine knows himself. Divine is not unknowable to himself. That would be an absurdity. He doesn't know himself. That would be like an infant who doesn't know himself. The divine knows himself by his own termless self. And it is only through that identity that we can know. There is no other way to know. That's why he is called the unknowable, because to the mind he is unknowable. Inane. Then there is a very interesting suggestion. It made and blotted out a million worlds. So there are two ways we can conceive of the absolute. One, that there is a relative and there is the absolute. So the world of relativities is a world of relativities, and the absolute is the absolute, independent of the relativities. Sri Aurobindo says that this is one of the lines that the Vedantic experience followed. And if we follow that line of experience, we enter into the absolute and drop this world completely. Everything is relative. Sab maya hai. But there is another way, that the absolute being absolute, it is not even bound to anything. It's not that we define it by saying absolute is free from relativities. No, that is a definition. So absolute is absolute in the sense it is absolute even in relativities, it is absolute. It does not diminish itself. It can play with relativities, forever remaining absolute. And we can understand it in a very simple way. The sense of finiteness, the limitation that we experience in life is actually not real. It is because the experiencing consciousness is limited and finite. So, for a caterpillar, there is a world that is caterpillar's world. For butterfly, there is another world. Emerging out of caterpillar, it experiences another world. For human beings, up this ladder as we go, our world is again decided by our senses and our thinking. What is our world? We say often, ki, kaun sa duniya mein hai, in which world are you in? We create our world and we are trapped in it. And this world, by our thinking, by our feeling, by our sensing, we fix the limits of this world and we live in it. And we are sometimes very happy to live in it, unless a blow comes and pushes us out of this world. So, if there is an infinite consciousness, for that there is no limitation. It will experience everything, but experience it as part of itself. Now, within our limited worlds, we experience other things. But what is beyond it, we cannot experience, because that is the limitation of a consciousness. But for the infinite, there is no limitation. It experiences everything, plays with everything, without losing a little of, even a little of itself. So essentially, the only way, if we have to really lead a divine life, that's why all this, we have to go through this great adventure, is to recover that infinite consciousness and base our life on that basis. It looks breathtaking. It looks, that's why it is an adventure. Of course, it's an adventure. We are seeking the supreme mystery. And this adventure should impel us with a greater joy, instead of feeling, oh my God, this is too much, where even sense fails, mind cannot grasp. That's why it's fascinating. What is the use of seeking something which the mind can grasp and the senses can seize? We can look at it this way. Very often, when these things are spoken of, one feels, this is too much. Well, that's why it is worth trying. If it was something like a thought or an idea, it wouldn't be worth the effort. So, another suggestion is very interesting. And took and lost 1,000 shapes and names. All names and forms are assumptions by the divine. That's why in Indian tradition we have two particular ways of naming. We have Vishnu Sahasranam, literally the 1,000 names of Vishnu. Now Vishnu in the original sense is the Paratpar Purusha, the eye that extends in heaven. That is how he is described. The later Puranic Vishnu in an image which also conjures a reality, we will see that, is seeing lying on the coils of the snake in its middle. And the mother describes this experience. She describes how she goes beyond the cosmic consciousness. We will read it probably tomorrow. And how she is identified with that being who is lying in the coils of time, and on the forehead of that serpent, there is a little child dancing over its head. And then she goes further beyond and all this drops off. She is identified with that which has no name. It's a very powerful experience. If I remember correctly, it is somewhere in November 1914, 3rd or 17th or 15th November 1914. We can go and check it. She speaks of this going further and further, ascending to the summits. This whole experience she has described. So, it took 1,000 names. All names and forms are the divine's names and forms. That's supreme. And that is why through all names and forms we can recover that formlessness. That state which is beyond all names. Even it's called as Anam. It has no name. It is also called as Satnam, the one true name. So there are so many ways of describing this truth. A distant greatness and a mystic closeness. To the mind, it's a distant greatness. If you try to think with the mind, Sri Aurobindo says, if you want to really have some mental glimpse of what that reality is, he describes a kind of meditation. It's really a very sobering meditation. It comes nowadays on the net, but in another form. In the net, it comes in a way that, you know, I am here, then you think, see the earth, then earth in context of the solar system, then solar system in the galaxy, galaxy in the cosmos. Now, where am I? Now, this is a powerful impact on the senses, but we can actually meditate, and it's worth trying sometime. He says, meditate, and with the power of the mind, imagine the farthest reaches of space. Now, having imagined the farthest reaches of space, try to go beyond. What is beyond? What is beyond this space? In what is it that these stars are drifting? Where are they going? What is accommodating them? What is making fresh ground? And if you really do it for just a few minutes, the whole mind is stunned into a kind of silence. Vast peace beyond our comprehension. So that is the vastness, a distant greatness, and all this is contained in him. But there is another way to experience it, and the Gita says that it is the simpler way, the more beautiful way, the delightful way, a mystic closeness. Shut it sweetly in. So yesterday we spoke of this experience of Duryodhana when he sees Krishna and Arjuna when he's terrified. There is a story, they want to avoid the Mahabharata war. So they all ask how to avoid it. So Sahadev, he is a mystic. He says there are three ways to stop the war. One, ask Draupadi to cut her hairs. Do this operation at night when she is sleeping. As long as she will not, you know, she has taken a vow, with Dushasan's blood I will make my choti. As long as she is none else but Kali, she will stick to her vow, even if it means destruction of the entire clan. Second, kill Bhima. This fellow is terrible. He has taken another vow to kill the 100 Kauravas. And nobody is capable of killing him except Bhishma, Drona, 2-3 persons were Karna, 3-4 were capable of killing him. Third, tie Krishna. So then Sahadev says, maybe you can persuade Draupadi to cut her hairs. Maybe Bhima can be killed. Drona, Bhishma and Karna were strong enough to kill Bhima. But Krishna cannot be tied. So Krishna is quietly listening to this entire conversation. He says, no, there is a rope that can tie me. He says, what is that rope? He says, with the rope of love I can be tied. So look at this expression, a mystic sweetness. That infinity becomes a small, minute form we cannot see inside. Mystic sweetness, shut it closely in. With that we come in contact every night. At another level, we experience it as a neutral, all-supporting void. Incommensurable, intolerant, bare reality, where all disguises fail. Nothing made could live. No structure of the nescience can be supported there. That is a point where it must fall, collapse. And then on page 307, we read these three lines. All he had been and all towards which he grew must now be left behind or else transform into a self of that which has no name. This is the clue. If we go with the mind, we cannot know anything and the mind cannot enter into that. So we have to either choose, leave behind. Or else, how is it that the divine knows himself? It must transform into that. These are the only two options. If we have the secret of transformation, how the divine knows himself, how he knows the world, how he relates with the world, that faculty, that consciousness we must acquire. That is the supramental truth consciousness. But if not that, then mind cannot enter. The soul has to go, leaving behind all these clothes, enter and dissolve itself. So this is the choice given to him, which offered nothing to the grasp of thought. Thought cannot understand. There is another consciousness which can understand. abandoned by the worlds of form, he strove. And then we read these last four lines. In an abysmal lapse of all things built, transcending every perishable support, and joining at last its mighty origin, the separate self must melt or be reborn into a truth beyond the mind's appeal. So here we are getting a first glimpse that the unknowable is not totally forever unknowable. He can be known if we transcend the mind and yet acquire that consciousness by which the divine knows himself. And here we have the first hint why Sri Aurobindo insists on the supramental transformation. It is possible to plunge into the infinite. Mystics have done it. Vedantins have done it. Tantrics have done it. But if we jump from the mind into it, we cannot find the link. We just come back from that samadhi, and when one asks, what did you experience? People who remain in that trance for months, they are not able to say what they experienced. At the most, they speak of a self, because it's impossible. The mind cannot embody that. So they have a choice, either to live by that memory or to eventually withdraw into it. But here there is another possibility which opens before Ashwapati, and very obviously he takes the other possibility, and therefore we see the first glimmer. All glory of outline, sweetness of harmony, rejected like a grace of trivial notes, expunged from being silence, nude, austere, died into a fine and blissful nothingness. The shunyam is not the shunyam of absence. The shunyam is the shunyam which is pregnant with infinity, dense contents of formlessness. That's how at another place he describes it. It is packed with all possibilities, and in its essential form it is experienced as delight. It's a blissful nothingness. The demiurges lost their names and forms. The demiurges are the great powers that have built these worlds. We have their names: Prajapati, Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh. All of them lost their names and forms because they had issued from the divine and they are back into that. They are there, but now they are working as enigmatic powers. The great schemed worlds that they had planned and wrought, passed, taken and abolished one by one. The universe removed its colored veil, and at the unimaginable end of the huge riddle of created things appeared the far-seen Godhead of the whole. So beautifully described, in one of the mystics describes it in this way. He says, this whole world is like a ghungat, veil, and that is the supremely luminous one. Uska mukh ek jyot hai, ghungat ye sansar. This world is a veil. When you lift the veil, then you see face to face with that supreme beloved, that light, that beauty. So here, now all the veils have dropped, and now appeared the far-seen Godhead of the whole. In one of the Upanishads, he is described as Prashna Upanishad, he is described as the one being, the Paratpar Purusha. So there are two sides, if one may say, of one reality. One is where it appears to the subjective sense as a blissful nothingness. Another where it's seen as the great being whose feet is the earth, whose head is made of fire, whose heart is the universe. Like that he is described. Mundak Upanishad describes like that. The entire creation is coming up out of his skin, is part of his body. Time, the quarter space is his hearing. Time is his breath. So that is how everything is inside him. So that Parat Par Purush. So Parbrahman is where it enters into and loses itself. Parat Par Purush, he shadows out of himself. That is the Sachidanand. Out of Parbrahm, there is a being shadowed forth for relation with relativities. It's the same reality. When it is experienced as featureless, relationless, then one loses into that, like a wave into an ocean. But for the sake of relationships, for relativity, for the world of relativity, he shadows forth a being, and that being is Sachidanand. And here there is a beautiful description of that. His feet firm based on life's stupendous wings, omnipotent, a lonely seer of time, inward, inscrutable with diamond gaze. This experience also the mother describes in one of her visions, which is not documented in prayers and meditation, how she sees that being with diamond eyes. And he is above and he is also hidden in the inconscient. And she goes there, and when she reaches into that depth, suddenly he opens his eyes. The whole cosmos is emerging out of that being. And she says he is the first avatar, the first descent into the inconscient. That same being has descended here. That mystery he will reveal in the next canto. Attracted by the unfathomable regard, the unsolved slow cycles to their fount returned, to rise again from that invisible sea. We have, this is the image, as we saw, Shobindu says that in the ancient Vedic thought, Vishnu represented this great being who is asleep on the great ocean of knowledge. Even knowledge stops there. It cannot reach to him. So what we call as knowledge, even higher knowledge, is nothing but another form of ignorance, because even knowledge rests at his feet. There is nothing to be known beyond it. It's an identity. There is no knower, no known, and therefore nothing to be known. There is no knowledge. Knowledge implies a knower and a known. We don't say, I am trying to know myself. Of course, we use the word when we want to know something greater. But the moment we are one with that last reality, the word knowledge becomes meaningless and absurd. All from his pusa born was now undone. Nothing remained, the cosmic mind conceives. Eternity prepared to fade and seemed a hue and imposition on the void. This is simply wonderful. What a wonderful experience. And it's worth losing everything for a glimpse of it. Toward the end of Savitri, when death, the mask of death is gone, all the worlds that death created have vanished. And then Shobindu reveals very beautifully, when he is face to face with that great being, all suffering was its easy price. All that one has undergone through countless lives appears like nothing. At this point it looks, oh my God, how much we have to be pained for reaching there. When we reach there, the values are reversed. We say, oh, that's all. Just a few hundred lives for this. That is the kind of experience which acts as a spur. Space was the fluttering of a dream that sank before its ending into nothing's deeps. At another place, Shobindu reveals to us what is space and time. When that, actually this Parabrahman and the Paratpar Purush are also given these two terms in Indian thought, Tat and Sat. So Tat is that, Parabrahman, Tat. When he manifests as Paratpar Purush, leaning forward, he is Sat, also known as Sat Purush. We don't have Tat Purush, it's Tat. And we can identify with that, Soham Asmi. But Sat is a Purusha, Sat Purush. So we have the famous mantra, Om Tat Sat. It's the highest mantra for this very reason. It brings in one single three words the entire truth. Om, the word that holds everything, is the bridge between that and this. Tat, that of which nothing can be said. Even to say he is nothing is to reduce him. We cannot say he is nothing. We cannot say he is. There is no way the mind can define it, because all definitions are one-sided exclusive truths. But he also deals with the world of relatives, relativities. Therefore, he is Sat, the one truth which manifests in a thousand ways. So we have Om Tat Sat. All from his Pusa born was now undone. So we have this, again this suggestion that everything emerges out of him, and it's not that things are separate, the cosmos is other than the transcendence. Eternity prepared to fade and seemed a hue and imposition on the void. Space was the fluttering of a dream that sank before its ending into nothing's deeps. So when that extends himself, it is space. When that enters into a state of motion, it becomes time. So time is born when that enters into a state of ever stable, yet it brings out of itself the mode of motion, the first stir, shobh, vibration of will, the first word, nad, whatever way we, that these terms, but in that ever stable, the first stir creates time. And its extension creates space. So space sinks into nothing's deep. Eternity prepares to fade, because nothing can be spoken of that. The spirit that dies not, and the Godhead self, seemed myths projected from the unknowable. The deathless spirit that dies not, and the Godhead self, seemed myths projected from the unknowable. From it all sprang, in it is called to cease. So Shobindo is using the neuter gender now. Everything emerged from it and everything ends in that. But what that was, no thought nor sight could tell. Only a formless form of self was left, a tenuous ghost of something that had been, the last experience of a lapsing wave. So this is the highest that any consciousness can arrive at, and that is the experience of the Sachidanand. Beyond it, it can choose to lose itself and it vanishes. This is how it's described by the mystics, drop merging into the ocean. But Sri Aurobindo doesn't want us to do that. He gives another reason, that all ocean lived within a wandering drop. To live out this mystery, our souls came here. A drop being in the ocean and yet not melting itself. And he gives why it is possible, how it is possible. We'll come to it a little later. But right now, let's enjoy that experience. The last experience of a lapsing wave before it sinks into a bornless sea. Once we sink into it, we drown, we vanish. There is nothing left anymore. We can't even say, I have merged. It's gone. As if it kept even on the brink of naught, its bare feeling of the ocean whence it came. A vastness brooded free from sense of space. An everlastingness cut off from time. A strange, sublime, inalterable peace, silent, rejected from it, world and soul. So this is the breathtaking experience. Just to read about it is to enter into some kind of a vastness, which one wonders what that is. A few moments of it is liberative, but this is not transformative. Sri Aurobindo says this experience gives a strong stamp on the consciousness. It doesn't transform, because it says if you want to be absorbed, fine. To transform, one has to find that link through which it expresses. It's a very powerful experience. A stark, companionless reality, answered at last to his soul's passionate search. Passionless, wordless, absorbed in its fathomless hush. There is no voice there, no answer, no question. To our passionate search, that is the end. No more seeking, no more finding, no more knowing. Keeping the mystery, none would ever pierce, none returns from there. It brooded, inscrutable and intangible. Inscrutable. We cannot pierce beyond it. It's infinite. So often people ask, what is beyond the infinite? It's an absurd question. Anything beyond it is still infinite. So the question carries no meaning. That's why it is called infinite. You cannot go beyond it. You cannot pierce it. Facing him with its dumb, tremendous calm, it had no kinship with the universe. There was no act, no movement in its vast. It's understandable why, having this experience, some of the Vedantins, with this one-sided experience, there is the other side which will, he has given a glimpse, it will come in the fullness in the next canto. But having this partial experience, they felt that the whole purpose of action is to arrive at that point where you drop action and merge into him. That's why they had this, because there is no action in that. There is no act. It's the ever stable, unmoving. But that's why we have the Ish Upanishad, which keeps on reminding us the ever stable and the ever one unmoving, one who is swifter than the mind. That is how he describes that supreme experience, the ever stable and the ever unmoving. And therefore it says the way of the works. But here we have one side of that experience. There was no act, no movement in its vast. Life's question met by its silence died on her lips. And those who follow this path, if you ask them questions, they will say, look, you want an answer, you arrive at that, your questioning will cease. It's true. When we enter into this, there is no question, there is no mind, there is no conception. So whatever questions we raise here has no meaning in that state of consciousness. That's why at one place he says, inane, the world's effort ceased, convicted of ignorance, finding no sanction of supernal light. There was no mind there with its need to know. There was no heart there with its need to love. That's why we have the famous Shankaracharya's Shivoham, Shivoham. There is nothing else. Na bandhu, na mata, na ghrana, na sparsham. Shivoham, Shivoham. That's the only thing he says. There is just that and nothing else. All person perished in its namelessness. There was no second. It had no partner or peer. Only itself was real to itself. How does one know it? By that identity. It is real to itself. A pure existence, safe from thought and mood. Shobindo, even in this this kind of a breathtaking height, has sometimes a touch of gentle irony. The irony here is safe. Look at the expression, from thought and mood. There is nothing which can reach or bind or create any kind of stir there. A consciousness of unshared immortal bliss. This is the reason, one of the reasons for creation. When Shobindo was asked, after all, why this creation? He says, obviously because there is something which is not there. Through creation, there is something which is gained even for the creator. So what is gained? What does he experience? He experiences a companionless bliss. What creation gives the possibility of? The bliss of union. The bliss of a myriad, myriads who are one. And that's why he says, what is divine life and why this creation has come out? He says, if we experience creation like a honeycomb, and if each drop of honey in each of the honeycomb could simultaneously experience all the honey in all the honeycomb, that is why this world is created. for this ananda. This ananda is not there. It is a companionless ananda. Very nice, but very boring, if one may say so. He is infinite. He would want to have infinite ways of ananta. This is a very nice mystic poetry. See, that's the only way we can speak about it. A mystic says, Amar Eke, it's in Bengali, I'll say in English, Amar Eke Krishna Mon Bhorena Ami Anant Krishna Dube Jai. I'm not happy with one Krishna. Fine, I have found one Krishna inside me and one Krishna above. I want to experience infinite Krishna in infinite ways. So that experience, that powerful experience, that's why creation is made. Not for this suffering, pain and everyday quarrels and struggle for existence and earning my daily bread. That is nonsense. That is like an animal. But to experience that ananda in multiple ways, in infinite ways, for that it is made. And that is where the tantric caught that truth. And they went so far as to say, whatever you do, it is Shiva who is the bhukta. That's why this experience gives only mukti. But the other experience gives bhukti. In fact, one of the very powerful tantras, Kularnava Tantra, which actually comes closest to Sri Aurobindo's yoga, it expresses something so boldly. It says, yoga is bhoga and bhoga is yoga. It can be completely misunderstood at the human level. It gives a path to that. How bhoga is yoga? He says there is no other bhokta but Shiva. Everything they do, but as a yogin, this is there in Arthur Avalon's book. He has written a powerful, beautiful book, The Serpent Power, and Sri Aurobindo has, he has really appreciated him. And that tantra comes closest. He says everything is a manifestation of that. He alone is. He is enjoying multiplicity of himself. But here there is one side of the experience. A consciousness of unshared immortal bliss. It is not shared. It is companionless. It dwelt aloof in its bare infinite, one and unique, unutterably soul. A being formless, featureless and mute. There is none to speak with. To start with, mute, that knew itself by its own timeless self. So how does the divine know himself? Well, he knows himself by himself. That's the only way. We want to know him? Well, identify with him, you will know. There is no other way. Aware forever in its motionless depths, uncreating, uncreated and unborn. He is the original cause. That's why all causality ends there. You cannot bind divine to any rule, norm, form, name, nothing. There is a status of the divine where no rules apply. We cannot say he is like that and if we do this, he will do like that. It's all our mind. Helpful in our stage to grow. It is not good to throw all caution to the winds. But to the divine, these rules don't apply. They apply to us. And it's good to know that we are not yet in that. So we move by these rules. But if we apply the same rules to the divine, that the divine would be like this, he should be like that, he should not be like that. Sri Aurobindo says, well, he can do anything. How are we to decide what he will do or what he will not do? He may choose to fail. He may choose to have errors. Whatever human mind conceives as errors. There is nothing which can be spoken of that perfect perfection that knew itself by its own timeless self, aware forever in its motionless steps. The one by whom all live, who lives by none. This is the suggestion also in the Ish Upanishad when he is described, says, he that went forth abode, he that went. Who is he? He describes he, the pure, without any sinews, without any form, free of all sin and evil. But next he says, he that has gone forth and become these worlds. So he is the pure, he remains untouched. That's why in Savitri elsewhere he says, the absolute, the perfect, the alone has called out of his silence the mute force. And next line he says, the absolute, the perfect, the immune, he is free from all evil and stain. Whatever happens is unstained by that. That is the state of freedom, and we can arise into that. An immeasurable, luminous secrecy guarded by the veils of the unmanifest. Above the changing cosmic interlude abode supreme, immutably the same, a silent cause, occult, impenetrable, infinite, eternal, unthinkable, alone. This ends this canto. One side, as we know, of a very powerful experience. We will read the other side of the same experience.